Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 3rd of April 2013 here in Japan, and today I'm joined on the line from Canada by Stefan Verstappen, an author and a researcher who is available at ChinaStrategies.com and who has published such books as The Art of Urban Survival, Chinese Business Etiquette, The 36 Strategies of Ancient China, and many other pieces of literature besides. So, Stefan, thank you so much for being on the program today. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me on, James. I really appreciate it.
Well, let's first introduce yourself for the listeners out there. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay, well, I'm born and raised in Toronto, and from an early age, I've been always asking and searching for the answers to, you know, the big questions. Why are we here? Why is society the way it is? And I followed, I've studied numerous religious paths and philosophies, and did a lot of reading when I was young, read everything I could get my hands on. I think I've read every major religious text and tract that I could get my hands on. And it was while I was researching a book on the 36 Strategies of Ancient China that I first realized that there was something wrong with society. It seemed that no matter what type of structure or a set of rules or philosophy we tried to institute, things would always turn out for the worst. In order to supply some background stories for the 36 strategies, I did a lot of research on history. I read Roman history, Chinese history, Japanese history, and you do see a pattern there, of civilization that rises and grows and reaches a certain golden age and then seems to always deteriorate and come to a crashing halt, followed by periods of anarchy and madness again. And one of the things when I was researching the history that I noticed was the nature of the great leaders. Now, it seems that every great leader, to have the name great in front of your name, implies that you've slaughtered lots of people. And I realized while studying these individuals that there was something wrong with them. For example, I could not do what they do. One of the chapters in another book that hasn't been published yet, but I was working on a chapter on leadership. And for that research, I, of course, studied all the great leaders. And I realized that I would make a terrible leader. I just don't have what it takes to be that ruthless. And so I began researching, and I came across Robert Hare's work. And before that, Checkley and the fellow that wrote People of the Lie, who was that, honey? Dr. Scott Peck, yelled to my wife over here, Dr. Scott Peck and People of the Lie. And when I was a young man, I'd already come up with a theory. At that time, I used to call them psychic vampires. It was sort of a term we used about people that seemed to suck the energy out of you and contribute nothing in return. And it wasn't until reading Robert Hare that sort of the pieces fell into place, that what I was seeing in all these great historical figures, and great, I mean, you know, the word it's they're described in history, but what I was seeing was a certain personality type, and it was a personality type totally alien to myself. And so that is how my research began. And then when I began writing my book, The Art of Urban Survival, which is basically a self-defense manual. It's I've been a martial artist for many years. I studied in Taiwan and Japan and Korea and Thailand, Hong Kong, and I've been teaching martial arts for about 25 years. I originally went into martial arts as sort of a spiritual discipline. I've always been a big guy, so I never really had to worry about being picked on or bullied. So from the very start, my martial arts experience has always been towards finding kind of the spiritual element in it. And although I did teach a lot of, you know, hand-to-hand combat with the local police here and women's self-defense groups and things like that, and all the time I was teaching the self-defense program, there was one thing that I couldn't teach them, and that was the kind of street smarts that you would need to have that would allow you to survive a potential life-threatening encounter with violent offenders. The I used to tell my students that if you find yourself in a back alley fighting off a street gang, you've already made three big mistakes. I mean, fighting is the last situation you should find yourself in. More important than that is being able to see the situation ahead of time, then being able to avoid it. And if you can't avoid it, to evade and, you know, quietly back out. I mean, I've been doing martial arts for 35 years. I've never had to punch anybody. I've been in a lot of tricky situations, and every one was solved peaceably with me just using my wits and talking to people, you know. I used to tell people, I can't get insulted. You can call me any name in the book, and I would just agree with you and offer to buy you a beer. Because for me, you know, verbal insults or anything like that is not worth all the dangers of hand-to-hand combat, because it's not just a matter of punching somebody in the face, but you could hit them and they could drop down and they could hit their head on the ground and have permanent brain damage, as we've seen in those recent clips with the police brutality and the young girl being knocked to the ground. And those stories are very common. I used to work for St. John Ambulance, and you hear of people being killed in a bar fight, but they're not really killed by being punched. They're killed by falling down to the ground and passing out. And then, of course, their head hits the ground. So for me, violence was really always the last resort. It's good to practice martial arts. It's good to know some self-defense techniques. But if you're actually using it, it's because you haven't used your brains. But in the context of a self-defense program, I could never teach what I'd known, which is, you know, street smarts. I grew up in one of Toronto's most notorious neighborhoods, and I was probably one of the first members of a street gang in Toronto. We're talking about the days when nobody locked doors, and the crime rate in Toronto was, I think, 4 murders per year at that time. So our street gang was pretty harmless compared to, you know, modern incarnations in the United States. But it still gave me a little bit of a street smart. Later on, I worked as a detached social worker, working with, you know, at-risk youth. And I worked with Toronto Boys Home, which was like a halfway house for young men that were in trouble with the law. And with them, what I used to do is they hired me to teach them wilderness survival. I would take them for week-long canoe trips up into Algonquin Park, which is a beautiful conservation park here in Canada. And I found more could be accomplished by, you know, taking them for a week in the woods than any amount of lecturing could do at a drop-in center. So when I began teaching the martial arts and the self-defense programs, I had all this knowledge. I'd grown up in a street gang, and I'd been a social worker, a street worker, and I'd worked with at-risk youth, and I knew that the self-defense program, it's okay, but really I'd rather you learn more about strategy and tactics and the way the world works. So I wrote the book, The Art of Urban Survival, which is, when I was writing it, I imagined my 19-year-old stepdaughter having this book. You know, she's going off to college for the first time, and her mother's worried and is driving her crazy with all the advice about, you know, don't take candy from strangers and don't even get into strange cars and so forth. And it was driving her crazy. And I thought, well, what I'd like to do is write a book for those type of people, young people, that don't have the kind of world experience yet and can still be suckered into a lot of different things that might do them harm later on. So in researching what to tell people for that book, the first chapter of the book is The Fence Against the Psychopath. I imagine that if we were, say, bunny rabbits and we were taking bunny rabbit self-defense courses, then the first thing the bunny rabbits would be discussing and learning about is foxes. So for humans, we all have our predators. I believe that we can't escape Mother Nature. There is a certain predator to prey ratio in Mother Nature. And I think humans believe that we've sort of evolved and we're no longer being eaten by tigers, but we are still being attacked. We still have our own predators. So what are those predators? What is the biggest danger to any individual or group? And to me, that danger is the psychopathic predator. So chapter one of the book is Defense Against a Psychopath. And I'd like to tell everybody, and I always do, that this is not my own original research. I'm not a psychologist. I'm just a, you know, your friendly neighborhood karate instructor. And I wanted to teach people what was the most dangerous thing in their life. And it's not the mugger. It's not the rapist waiting in the alley. The typical stereotypic myth that all self-defense courses pretend to address, those really aren't the dangers we face. The dangers we face are from charming people that know how to manipulate people and know how to get what they want from you. So the first chapter was Defense Against a Psychopath, and I wrote it as a Reader's Digest version of all the available literature that was available. I didn't want to get into detail with it. It's not the book is not about psychology or mental illnesses or disease. The book is about self-defense. So I wanted to separate it from the context of clinical psychology. And I gave a kind of Reader's Digest version of the most important and salient details that you would need to know so that you yourself could protect you individually and your family from these types of predators.
Now, as an adjunct to that chapter, you have a documentary that you have up on your YouTube channel, which I'll link to in the show notes for this interview, and you have a 37-minute documentary, Defense Against the Psychopaths, and it's gotten quite a lot of attention online. It now has over 170,000 views, and it is a good overview, I think, of the subject, and talks about, for example, some of the different types of psychopaths that that exist in our society, because this does tend to manifest itself in different ways in different spheres of our society. So perhaps you can talk a little bit about the different types of psychopaths that you've identified and how they interact with others in our society.
Well, again, the chapter on psychopath is kind of distilled from existing writings from different people. What I did is I took some of the subcategories of psychopaths and I kind of mixed them together. The DSM-V manual is always changing the definitions and the nomenclature is kind of changing all the time too. So it gets a little bit, people can get into splitting hairs with it. And I didn't think it was necessary to split hairs, not for the purpose of this this book and this video. So what I call secondary psychopaths or what other people might call created psychopaths or subfunctioning or subclinical psychopaths. So I've taken all those categories and rolled them into one. But for the benefit of the readers, I've designated basically three types of psychopaths. You have your malevolent psychopath, which is the one that's most commonly displayed in culture and in movies, and the one everyone's pretty much familiar with, the serial killer, the mass rapist, or the serial rapist, the type of street gang leaders, the guys that are all tattooed up with the piercings and career criminals. And those people are often called sociopaths, but again, I'm not, I don't want to split hairs on the terminology. To me, they're the malevolent type. They look mean, they are mean, they're violent, they're vicious, and they're quite dangerous. But those type of people are usually pretty easy to spot, because they tend to be scary looking characters. The second type of psychopath, which is more, which I think is much more dangerous than the malevolent psychopath, is the professional psychopath. These are the people that mimic and camouflage themselves perfectly to fit into society. I've had some friends that were professional psychopaths, and personally, I like them. I had a buddy in Taiwan. He was a great guy, and we'd go out drinking and have a lot of fun, and he was charming, he was witty, he was good looking, and everybody liked him. But the essential difference with him was, and with the professional psychopaths, is even though they have all the sort of fake charm and the glibness, and they can be a lot of fun to be around, ultimately, no good comes from them. They simply do not have the ability to care about you. And so their actions are never guided by the principle of, well, would this hurt the person I was with, or would this offend them, or would this cause them a loss? So long as you're not risking anything personally in terms of emotional commitment or financial commitment, well, they're charming. You can meet them at a party, have a couple of drinks, they tell a good joke. But if you ever get involved with them emotionally or financially, you'll find that you do not matter whatsoever. You are simply a source of supply for them. Emotional supply, attention, admiration, adoration, or a source of financial supply to them. And if you can identify that, you can at least guard yourself and protect yourself and not leave yourself wide open to be exploited. And then for me, the third type of psychopath is what we call the created psychopath. And these are people that I don't know how to say it. It's still a mystery. I've been researching it, and I continue to go over the data and try and figure out if I missed something. But I personally find it very hard to explain. I guess it's the only thing you can say is that they're weak-willed. They don't have a lot of personal character. They don't have. They weren't born with an ingrained sense of morality, a separate morality aside from a cultural morality that we're taught in schools and culture. And these people are then easily influenced by culture. And the culture that we live in now, I think, is pretty much psychopathic. And so what they do is, because they don't have a strong character, they don't have their own critical thinking, they adopt the type of characteristics of the psychopathic characters around them. And therefore, they begin to act like a psychopath. Now, they may have feelings of conflict deep down inside. I don't know. I think they do. The human mind is a black box. We can only guess what's going on by the reactions received on the outside. We don't really know what's going on inside. So perhaps they're having a moral conflict when they behave this way, or perhaps they're completely oblivious to it. But the end result is they are behaving like a psychopath. I'll give you an example, and I use that one individual too, is if you're born in, say, a rough neighborhood, and a neighborhood that's plagued by gangs, and you're a 13-year-old boy, you don't have too many choices. You can either be the victim of all the gangs and get bullied on the way to school, or you can decide to join the gang. Now, the gang itself is pretty much a psychopathic entity, which I think all groups are. A group has no conscience. Therefore, a corporation has no conscience. And that's why we can see corporations causing the amount of worldwide destruction that we do now, because individuals in a corporation, they may be nice people, they might be family men, wives and mothers, but the corporation itself has no conscience. And so I feel the same applies to most groups. So a street gang has no conscience. Now, if you're a 13-year-old boy, once you join the street gang and they decide to go beat up the other kid that they're bullying, you cannot have sympathy for that kid that you're beating up, or you'll quickly be out of the gang, you know. And I've seen that happen, the peer pressure. You know, everybody has to do this, everybody has to do that. And if you don't do that, you're not part of the gang, you're not part of us. And so they adopt these types of behaviors, but essentially those behaviors are psychopathic. So that is the created psychopath.
Well, you mentioned the idea of the culture itself being psychopathic and corporations being psychopathic. The environment that we're being steeped in is psychopathic in a sense that helps to foster and to create more psychopaths in its wake. Let's talk about that concept. And in such a system, it would, of course, only be natural that the psychopaths tend to rise to the top. So what does that really mean for the society that we're living in and the times that we find ourselves in, with the kind of rampant fraud that's taking place on Wall Street and all of the economic and political things that we see taking shape from this? How is that created or fostered by this culture of psychopathy?
Well, you know, that it took me a few years to figure that out, and I put that in the video too. The video, I simply read from the book, but then I added images that were sort of unexpected. And so when I'm talking about the psychopaths, I would flash images of politicians and political leaders and business leaders. I think what happened is, I think mankind, now that I've thought, you know, done a lot more research on it, and you can see the effects, and it's logical. Everyone will come to the same conclusion. It's very simple. If I make an analogy, you're playing a game of chess with someone, and you're playing by the rules. But every time you move a chess piece, you now have to turn your back on the chessboard, and your opponent can rearrange all the chess pieces. Now you turn around and you continue playing. Well, you're never going to win a game of chess that way. The cheater is always going to win. So you extrapolate on that principle, and then you realize, well, in every competition in life, the cheaters are going to have an advantage. The people that act immorally, the ones that have no regard for truth, have no regard for their own character or honesty, an honest day's work, they're definitely going to have the advantage against the guy that's always playing by the rules. So what would the natural outcome of that be? Well, the natural outcome would be that people in power will tend to be the ones that are the most sociopathic, the ones that are most ruthless, and the ones that have no conscience. And again, when I refer back to the study of history, the great leaders and all the emperors and the shoguns and the kings and queens, they tend to have been the worst of the bunch. You know, when there's a dynastic family and there's four brothers fighting for succession to the throne, it's always the evilest brother of the bunch that tends to become king. So if I apply that to other areas of life, then you can see that the psychopaths would tend to permeate and rise to the top of any type of position where they are able to wield power. And the last thing I found out about psychopaths, and is one of the clues to really tell who they are, is that they all have one thing in common, and that is they all want to tell you how to live your life. They want to tell you what to do. It's somehow their business what you do with your life. Now, for me, I think so long as you're not hurting anyone and not hurting any animals, you're basically allowed to do what you want. You know, if you want to drink and smoke and have sex with people and things like that, it's none of my business what you do, where you go, who you socialize with. But psychopaths seem to have this innate desire to always manipulate you in order to do what they want you to do or what they think you should be doing. So any position of power, of course, in a position of power, what is power? The ability to tell people what to do and how to live their lives. So for any position of power, the psychopaths are going to be naturally attracted to that because that's what gets them off. They just want to tell everybody where to get off. So if you have this attraction for psychopaths towards that position of power, then they will definitely overwhelm anyone that has a conscience, that plays by the rules, that has good intentions. So now you're going to have people with very dark interior lives that are controlling channels of communication, controlling finance, controlling different industries. And of course, what they're going to do is promote what I call their psychopathic family values. You know, America was always big on their family values slogans back in the 90s and 80s. Their values are basically psychopathic. And I think their influence is now permeated all facets of culture. I see it all the time. You're familiar with the term gaslighting, where a group of people conspire together to make you think that you're the crazy one. Well, I go crazy all the time because I can't watch a TV show, I can't watch a movie, I can't read a newspaper article without noticing that they're promoting a psychopathic agenda. The Survivor series or the Big Brother series, and those reality shows. I think I've watched about 5 minutes of either one once. But what is the basic premise of the whole program? The premise of the program is that a group of people interact and they all try to manipulate the other group of people through lies and intimidation and deception. And then the winner is the one who's the biggest jerk, the one that's able to manipulate and deceive the others the most, that now they're the winner. So now people watching this program go, wow, he's a great winner because he's the biggest liar of the bunch. All the honest people are voted off first or kicked out first or lose first until the final result is the biggest jerk wins. And I find that in just about every television program. They're always promoting these selfish, self-centered, philosophy. And at first it started off as, you know, it was cute. Oh, yeah, we're all very self-centered and we're selfish. And isn't that kind of funny that we can admit to it? And I kind of got suckered into that, too, when it started happening back in the early 80s. I thought, well, okay, yeah, that's cute. People tend to be a little bit deceptive and we all tell a little white lies. And, of course, we do. But there's a big degree between telling white lies and being a full-blown psychopath and manipulating everybody to your own advantage. So I think the final result is that our culture is predominantly psychopathic. I find I'm an artist, for example, and I find contemporary art to be absolutely hideous. I see no value in it whatsoever. It seems to promote just ugliness and lack of harmony and lack of balance. I'm a musician. I like to play music, but I find modern music to be inhuman, you know, with all the auto-tuning and the repetitious sound clips played back-to-back. I don't think any of these modern pop stars even know how to tune an instrument, let alone play one. So how can you be a musician if you can't find concert A on the piano? So I find modern music to be completely psychopathic. Movies, what can I say? You know, you see the movies, the hero is always the guy with the biggest gun that shoots the most amount of people. I find it ironic they're trying to confiscate guns because in between the gun confiscations, they run all these movies about every hero has a big gun and is willing to use it and kill thousands of people. And there's no conscience. Nobody ever thinks that maybe some of these bad guys have families or children that are now going to be orphaned and have to suffer a lifetime of financial deprivation. No, it's fine. The hero has a big gun. You let him kill everybody, and at the end, he gets the girl. I find that completely psychopathic. The educational system, I'm proud to say I dropped out of high school in the 11th grade. If I knew then what I know now, I would have dropped out of grade school if I could have. I went to university afterwards for a few years, but I found that a complete waste of time, too. So all aspects of our culture, I find it to be predominantly psychopathic. Religion as well. Don't even get me started on religion, all the major religions. I have no use for any of it. I find it completely contrary to developing goodness or morality in people. I don't see how it works that way at all. Actually, it works the opposite way. And I've come now to the conclusion that I don't know what human beings are anymore. And what I mean to say is I still stay positive. My wife and I, we love people and we love meeting people and we love doing things for people. We're activists and we always contribute to the local charities and events. So, you know, I'm not down on humankind, but what I think has happened is that human beings aren't what they are, their potential is. And if I make another analogy, we'll take the case of a dog. If you were to get a puppy dog and you beat it and you keep it in a cage and you're constantly conflicting it with conflicting orders, you love it, you don't love it, you smack it, you hate it, eventually that dog is going to grow up to be neurotic and vicious. And I think humanity is exactly like the beaten dog. We have been beaten for I guess about 4,000 years now, because now we have our culture, but before that we had the divine right of kings, and of course every king tended to be a psychopath. And then before that we had the religious institutions, and they weren't promoting anything healthy. So if you add it all up, we've had 4,000 years of the human population being enslaved, being manipulated, being extorted, being driven crazy with conflicting philosophies and theories. And I think the human species as a whole is like a beaten dog. It's vicious. They're confused. They're neurotic. And so that's the state of affairs.
It is a bleak picture, but I think a fair assessment of where we've arrived at as a society. And the question is defense against the psychopath. In the case of on the personal level, when you have someone in your personal life who's exhibiting psychopathic tendencies, I think you lay out, for example, in the video, it's important to be able to identify that it is psychopathy, and in that case, that it is not something that can be reformed. It's not something that you can reach out and find the inner conscience of the person, because it simply doesn't exist. So in that case, the best thing that you can possibly do is to completely detach yourself from that person and get them out of your life, if possible. But when it comes to societal psychopathy and the fact that these people are in positions of power and in governmental structures and in the tops of large corporations, what does that bode for society itself? Is there a way for society to defend itself against this this takeover by the psychopaths?
Yeah, well, that's a good point that you mentioned, and in your email, that was a very good point that you raised as well. Or, I'm sorry, in the video that you did, which is, well, can we just sort of isolate the psychopaths in society and cut them off? And the book was written for individuals, Jeff. And on an individual level, you do have to have a cold exterior to them, because they always try to manipulate you by playing on your sense of fairness and on your sympathy. And those of us that feel and have a conscience, there's a part of me that feels sorry for psychopaths too. They don't enjoy the fullness of life that I do. I understand that. And they probably can't help being a psychopath. There was something innate in them when they were either born, and then either genetically, or there was a gene that was triggered later on through abuse. But however they came to that state, they are probably not responsible. It's like, I don't think they ever had a choice. So I feel badly for them, but they're like a cancer cell, you know. I mean, it's part of your body, and you might have sympathy for the cancer, but you have to cut it out anyways. So in personal relationships, I recommend isolating yourself, cutting them off, because psychopaths consider you food. And once you stop being food, they will tend to be like a leech. They'll just drop off on their own once you cut them off from the food supply. And psychopaths have a very similar life cycle to parasites. A lot of similarities there. I'm working on another video that would link and show how the parasitic strategy of survival is the one that tends to be adopted by psychopaths. But socially, that's a different question. And a lot of people said, well, you know, we can't do this. We can't. What we should do is we should have a test and test all politicians to see whether they're psychopaths. And then if they are, imprison them. Or a lot of people advocate shooting them and other forms of violence. And I think this would be an absolute disaster. I do not think any sort of test or screening process would either work or be necessary. Well, it wouldn't work. Any kind of screening process, some sort of test that you come up with to prove whether or not somebody's a psychopath would quickly be subverted by the psychopaths in power right now. They've subverted every law we've established and every democratic system or Republican system or system of government rules and procedures and morality and codes of conduct. They've subverted all those in the past 4,000 years. None of those things have worked on them. I seriously doubt that any kind of test is going to work on them. They'll quickly take it over. They'll bribe, blackmail, or eliminate whoever's in charge of those tests, and the test will be reversed, and soon it'll be anybody that has a conscience should be executed. So what to do with society, how to change it around? You know, we're always talking about, and especially in the truth movement and in the activist movement, and everybody's always talking about waking people up. And I got to be really sick of that. Well, okay, let's wake everybody up, and then what happens? But unfortunately, I'm back to the waking people up approach. I don't think we can sort of find any search and destroy method of getting rid of psychopaths. But the psychopaths derive their power from the complicity of the general population. It's only because most people still get suckered in by the manipulation, and most people still admire them. You know, all the girls go after the bad boy. And, you know, I was a bad boy when I was younger, and chased a lot of girls, and a lot of girls loved the bad boy image. But the bad boys, most of the time, or tends to be mostly the psychopaths. And the whole society as a whole tends to admire the bad boy image, which is fine. I mean, we all want to be independent and sort of revolutionary. But most of the bad boys out there, they're just psychopaths. And we have to be able to discern between what is a true individual and what is a psychopath just trying to manipulate and feed off the rest of the population. So if somehow, and I'm hoping the video and the book, and there's also a booklet you can download, and people spreading the word about what psychopaths are, if the better informed they are, the better able they are to spot them and then start to socially distance them. It's the same sort of strategy that you would use if there was a pandemic. You have to socially distance yourself from the infection and infected people. And I think society as a whole, if we can socially distance ourselves from the psychopaths, and we don't need a test, we don't need anybody to tell us. If you recognize the patterns and the symptoms, even whether your diagnosis is wrong or not, your behavior is not going to harm them simply by cutting them off of food, meaning your money, your attention, your devotion. So you're not hurting them by cutting them off. You're depriving them of what they want. You're depriving, you're depriving a junkie of heroin. But you can't say by removing heroin from a junkie, you're actually doing violence against the junkie. So the same thing with society. If we can sort of isolate these people and then remove their access to the power, then we can cut them off. And we're not doing violence to them, yet they won't be able to have the power and control to create so much destruction and evil. And there's no other word for it. It's evil what's going on in the world. So I'm back down to waking people up. Yeah.
Well, I think ostracism can be an exceptionally powerful way of dealing with these types of problems and with people who want to try to exercise their power. And of course, that does rest on our ability to identify these psychopaths and understand what they are. So I think it's important for society as a whole to start to come to a greater awareness of that. And I know that there's a lot of work of this going on in the alternative media, but hopefully we can break through into the mainstream paradigm as well. So for people who are interested in your work and want to read more, tell people again where they can go and how they can access your work.
Well, all my books are on Amazon.com. So if you look up my name, Stefan Verstappen, on Amazon, you'll see a listing of books. I have a few up there. The works on the chapter on defense against a psychopath is in the book called The Art of Urban Survival. And it goes into from the first chapter on psychopaths, it ends up with a chapter on how to survive martial law, war, revolution, as well as, you know, end of the world type scenarios. So it covers the full range of all the possibilities of what can go wrong living in the big city. And you can find that again on Amazon.com. My website is www.chinastrategies.com, and you'll find more information there.
Absolutely. And of course, I'll link all of that up in the show notes for this interview as well. So, Stefan Verstappen, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, James. It's really been a thrill.